Thanks to our hosts for putting together this conference, which we've all enjoyed a lot. And we've had a very exciting time here. And today I will talk about a background in dependent algebra in quantum gravity. So in ordinary quantum field theory without gravity, in a space-time M, we can pick an arbitrary open set U in M, and then we can define an algebra of observables localized in that open set. Schematically, here's an arbitrary region, which I've taken to be a diamond-shaped region, in a space-time M. There are a variety of problems with this notion in the presence of gravity, and I'll point out three problems. The most obvious problem is that since space-time fluctuates, it's in general difficult to describe a space-time region in quantum gravity. So without gravity, we can literally pick any open set we want in space-time. With gravity, we're restricted to an open set that we can define in some invariant fashion, which in general is rather restrictive. For example, in a cosmological model, you'd have trouble identifying an open set. However, there's a problem that perhaps is slightly less obvious and possibly deeper that concerns background independence. In ordinary quantum field theory, when we associate an algebra A sub U to an open set U in M, that association, of course, depends on M and U, but it doesn't depend on the state of the quantum fields. Well, for gravity, what would be the analog of not depending on the state of the quantum fields? In gravity, the space-time M is part of what the space quantum fields determine. So an algebra that doesn't depend on the state of the quantum fields should be defined universally, independently of M. So that's actually what I will mean by a background-independent algebra. It should be something that we can define without referring to any space-time. By contrast, as soon as we define an algebra of try to define an algebra of observables in a region, we've kind of lost the game. That will always depend on the region and the space-time, at least on the region, perhaps also on the space-time. So that's a second problem, and in a way, the main problem for today. But a third problem concerns the question of why we're trying to define an algebra in the first place. What is the algebra supposed to mean? In ordinary quantum mechanics, an observer is external to the system, and we can make any assumption we want about the capability of the observer. We're actually doing that in quantum field theory implicitly when we discuss the algebra associated to a region. We're free to imagine an observer who can probe a system at will, but only in a specified region of space-time. We could assume something else if we wanted to, but we can certainly assume this. And this is the context in which it makes sense to consider the algebra A sub U. It's the algebra of operators accessible to that observer. In gravity, at least in a closed universe or in a typical cosmological model, which will be the most natural framework for today's lecture, there's no one who can probe the system from outside. So an algebra only has operational meaning if it's the algebra of operators accessible to some observer. So what do we mean by the algebra of operators accessible to an observer? Following a lot of previous authors, such as UNRWA, I'll model an observer by a time-like world line, which we could assume, we don't have to assume it to be a geodesic, we could assume the observer is equipped with a rocket engine. But we will take the simplest model where the time-like world line is a geodesic, and we'll assume that what the observer can measure are the quantum fields along the world line. Now, it might sound like too crude a model, but there are a number of things that indicate that it isn't. For one thing, there's something called the time-like tube theorem of ordinary quantum field theory, which asserts that in quantum field theory without gravity, the algebra of operators along the world line is equivalent to the algebra of operators in a certain open set. So if the world line is this one, where here I've drawn a world line bounded in time, the open set is its so-called time-like envelope, which in this case is drawn in red. So the algebra of operators along a time-like geodesic would appear to make sense even in the presence of gravity. But in ordinary quantum field theory, it would be similar, well, the equivalent to the algebra of operators in a certain open set. So this looks like a reasonable substitute for what we usually consider in the absence of gravity, where we discuss operators in an open set. And it seems to make more sense when gravity is included. So that's the framework we'll be in for today's lecture. Now, there are a bunch of relevant papers that provide backgrounds. I'll just say that these papers were actually my starting point for working in this direction. I don't have time to explain what's been done in various previous papers, so I'll just say that the lecture will be largely devoted to rethinking what was done in this paper, which was about an observer in de Sitter space. So as I just said, my starting point will be to reinterpret that paper, which was on the static patch in de Sitter space. So in that paper, we wanted to define an algebra of observables for the static patch in de Sitter space. And we observed that there was a problem. Because of the symmetries of the static patch, we could not get a sensible answer unless we postulated the existence of an observer in the static patch. Given an observer in the static patch, we could define an algebra by gravitationally dressing an observer, an operator, to the observer's world line. And then it turned out to give a nice answer, which led, among other things, to a nice interpretation of the de Sitter entropy. Now, this logic for introducing an observer doesn't apply in a more general spacetime. In a more general, generic spacetime with less symmetry, we could gravitationally dress an operator to a feature of the spacetime or of the state. So, in a general spacetime, we might have trouble defining what we mean by a region, but to the extent we can define a region, we could also not have this difficulty here that would have motivated introducing an observer. However, that logic would lead us to define something, but that something would not be background independent. Today, we're going to consider the same construction, basically, as in this paper, but with a different motivation, which will be not the symmetries of de Sitter space, but rather wanting background independence. Now, before going on, I should answer a question that's often asked. We expect that in a full theory of quantum gravity, unlike ordinary quantum mechanics, an observer cannot be introduced from outside, but must be described by the theory. So then what it means to assume the presence of an observer is that we define an algebra that makes sense in a subspace of states in which an observer is present. We don't try to define an algebra that makes sense in all states. Now, first let me describe something we could do in the absence of gravity. So the observer is living in a spacetime M on a geodesic gamma. And we parameterize the world line by proper time tau. The observer measures along gamma, for example, a scalar field phi, or the electromagnetic field F mu nu, or the Riemann tensor R mu nu alpha beta, which since for the moment there's no gravity, this would be a C number, but anyway, it's a C number characteristic of the spacetime that the observer can measure. And the observer also measures covariant derivatives of all these things in normal directions. Now focus on a particular observable, say phi evaluated at the position the observer has, namely x, at proper time tau. But I'll abbreviate it just as phi of tau. Well, what I've said makes sense in the absence of gravity, but in the presence of gravity, there's going to be a subtlety, which is that a priori, we don't know how the observer world line is embedded in spacetime. The observer world line, let's say, has an intrinsic metric as measured by the proper time along the world line, but that's only defined up to an additive constant. When we take gravity to be dynamical, we have to consider that the same world line can be embedded in a given spacetime in different ways, differing by constant shifts of the proper time of the observer. So phi of tau ceases to be a meaningful observable when we pass to gravity. We need to introduce the observer's degree of freedom and define tau relative to some kind of clock carried by the observer. So in a minimal model, I'll give the observer a rest mass mc squared, which will be the minimum energy of the observer. And then the observer will have a Hamiltonian mc squared plus q. Q will be non-negative to make mc squared the minimum energy of the observer. And then there will be a canonical variable p equals minus id by dq. So as I've already said, we want to assume the observer energy is bounded below. So we'll take q to be non-negative, meaning that m is the observer rest mass. And then we only allow operators that preserve the condition that Q is non-negative. So for example, E to the IP isn't a legal operator because it wouldn't preserve Q being positive. Any operator, though, becomes legal if you sandwich it between the projection operator theta of q onto states where q is non-negative. So an example of a legal operator is pi e to the ip times pi. Any operator becomes legal if you multiply it before and after by the projection operator pi. Now, we want to only allow operators that commute with what I call h hat, where h bulk is a bulk operator that acts on the fields, the gravitational field and all the other ambient fields. And h observer is an observer that acts on the observers. Well, h observer is what I wrote here, mc squared plus q. So h bulk is any gravitational constraint operator that generates a shift of tau along the world line. When you shift tau by a constant, there are many different morphisms that would do that. I'm not telling you what they do away from the world line. It doesn't matter, because away from the world line, we've imposed diffeomorphism symmetry. But along the world line, we have diffeomorphism symmetry up to a shift of the observer's clock. So after imposing all the constraints away from the world line, we impose one more constraint, which is that allowed operators commute with this. Now, h bulk acting on phi of tau is minus I phi dot, where dot means d by d tau. So to satisfy this constraint, we need q commuted with phi of tau to be also I phi dot. And you'll observe that we can achieve that condition by just setting tau to be equal to p, or more generally, p plus a constant s. So an example of an operator that satisfies the constraint would be phi evaluated not at an arbitrary real number tau, but at p plus s. So, by the way, you might be slightly confused what I mean by taking the operator phi evaluated where its argument is another operator. To convince yourself it makes sense, you could imagine diagonalizing p. Then in each eigenstate of p, p plus s is just a number, and you would understand what's meant by phi of p plus s. But since I've explained what this means in a basis, that means you understand it as an operator. But to get an allowed operator in this problem, we multiply before and after with the projection operator. So allowed operators really take this form. And there's one more obvious operator. Okay, so for these operators, phi could be replaced by any local field along the world line, such as the electromagnetic field or the Riemann tensor, or their normal derivatives, normal to the world line. But there's one more obvious operator we should include because it commutes with h hat, which is q itself. So we define an algebra A sub observer that's generated by q along with these funny operators. Now, this setup hopefully sounds background independent, since I described it without picking a background. But to really make it background independent, I need to tell you something else. We have to interpret the formulas properly if we want this to truly be background independent. We won't get background independence if we think the symbols I've written are Hilbert space operators. The reason is that to get a Hilbert space on which phi hat s acts, we have to pick a spacetime m in which the observer lives. But that's exactly what we didn't want to do, because then we won't have background independence. So the right interpretation is that the algebras we would get for different m's are inequivalent representations of the same underlying operator product algebra. To get background independence, we should think of A sub observer as an operator product algebra, not an algebra of Hilbert space operators. In the absence of gravity, we would have a universal short distance expansion, of which I've written a leading term here, and there are well-known subleading terms with operators of higher dimension. We could write formulas like that, and we do, and for example, in QCD, it's very important that we can, with no knowledge about the quantum state. There are universal short distance relations. After coupling to gravity and including the observer in the constraint, the short distance expansion becomes an expansion in 1 over q. So we characterize A observer by the universal short distance, or 1 over q, expansion of operator products. In that sense, it's background independent. Now, having defined this background independent algebra, I'll now introduce the concept of a state of the observer. A state is a linear function on operators accessible to the observer, which obeys two axioms. One is it's positive in the sense that the expectation value of OO dagger is always non-negative. And two is it's consistent with all universal OPE relations. So if you take the expectation of a product of two operators, that will have a large Q expansion that is consistent with universal relations. This is analogous to a definition given by Holland and Wald in a different context in a fixed curved spacetime. If M is any spacetime, but that was an abstract definition of a state. Now let me give you a more down-to-earth definition. The observer might be living in some spacetime M, and you might specify a combined state psi of the system consisting of fields in M together with the observer. Then you could take the expectation value of O and the state psi. Well, that's a state of the observer by the definition I gave. So the definition I gave of the state of the observer encompasses any state in the usual sense in any spacetime in which the observer might live. Now, these definitions make sense for any M, but I think they're most interesting when, because of horizons, the observer cannot see the whole universe. There's a very special case that turns out to be important. That's the case that M is an empty de Sitter space with some positive value of the effective cosmological constant. So here I've drawn the Penrose diagram, and it can be drawn so that the observer world line is the left boundary of the diagram, and then the green region is the so-called static patch, the region that's to the future of the past horizon and to the past of the future horizon of the observer, the region the observer can see and influence. It's called a static patch because it's invariant under a particular de Sitter generator H that advances the proper time of the observer. So it can be used as the constraint operator in the general abstract discussion. Now, in the absence of gravity, there's a distinguished de Sitter invariant state, which I'll call psi ds. It goes by various names, but I'll just call it psi sub ds, such that this correlation functions in this state are thermal at the de Sitter temperature, which I'll call 1 over beta ds. Now, thermality means, for example, that two-point functions have two key properties. One is time translation symmetry. If you take a two-point function at times tau and tau prime, but you shift both times by common constant s, it's invariant. Here, phi and phi prime are any two scalar fields. The prime on phi prime just refers to a different, possibly different scalar field. It's not a derivative. So that's a kind of trivial property in any time-independent spacetime. Thermality is the KMS condition, which says that if you reorder the two operators and compensate by shifting tau to tau minus I beta, you get an invariance of the thermal correlator. There isn't quite time to explain that condition properly, but I'll just say that a precise statement involves holomorphy in a strip in the complex plane. Now, something very nice happens when we include gravity in the observer. We define a special state in which the observer energy has a thermal distribution at the de Sitter temperature. So that state is just an exponential of minus beta ds times the observer Hamiltonian over 2. Well, I dropped the mc squared, the constant. Well, if you like, I absorb the constant in the normalization factor. So this is a normalized state in which the observer energy is thermally distributed at the de Sitter temperature. And also, in passing to gravity, we have to replace this kind of operator by the gravitationally dressed version, which are these. And something happens which I think is very nice. So the two properties you have in the absence of gravity go over to two properties you have in the presence of gravity. One of them is pseudo-obvious, which is time translation symmetry. So S and S prime are kind of shifted times, and if you shift them both by a constant C, you get an invariance. So it's fairly obvious what time translation symmetry will mean, but it's less obvious what the KMS condition will mean. And the KMS condition simplifies. Without gravity, the KMS condition does not say you can reorder the two operators. There's a crucial shift by minus I beta. But that goes away when you couple to gravity. Now, So this fact is really nice to prove, and it has an extremely elementary proof, which I really wanted to explain today, but I reluctantly concluded I just wouldn't be able to, and also give the rest of the talk in a reasonable way. The last condition, though, tells us that if for any element A of the algebra, we define the trace of A to be its excitation value in this gravitationally dressed version of the de Sitter invariant state, then that function trace does have the algebraic property of a trace. The trace of AB equals the trace of BA. It also has the property that the trace of A dagger A is non-negative, or positive for all non-zero A, meaning in particular that it's a non-degenerate trace. And since I made psi max the normalized state, the trace of the identity is 1. So now let H sub ds be the Hilbert space we get by quantizing fields in de Sitter space in perturbation theory. I'm going to have to skip a few details. Let psi be any state in this Hilbert space and consider the excitation value of the operator in the state psi. Roughly speaking, because the algebra has a non-degenerate trace, we can hope that there's a density matrix in the algebra such that the excitation value of A in any state psi is the trace of A times rho. That's a definition that doesn't work in quantum field theory in the absence of gravity, because there's no trace. That's related to the fact that entropies are always divergent. Here, such a trace does exist, although it exists not as an element of the algebra as I've defined it so far, but in a completion of that algebra, which is a point I'll have to skip. But basically, such a rho does exist for any state psi in the Hilbert space. So here, a density matrix is defined in the usual way as a positive operator in the algebra whose trace is 1. And every state has a density matrix, just as in ordinary quantum mechanics. The definition of the trace makes it clear that the density matrix of the maximum entropy state is 1, because the density matrix sigma max of the maximum entropy state is supposed to satisfy this condition, but the trace was defined so that this is equal to that. So to make this equal to that, sigma max should be 1. So the state sigma max has a density matrix of 1, meaning it's maximally mixed, similar to a maximally mixed state in ordinary quantum mechanics whose density matrix is a multiple of the identity. Now, once we know that every state has a density matrix, we can define entropies as well by the usual definition of the von Neumann entropy. In ordinary quantum mechanics, a maximally mixed state has a density matrix that's a multiple of the identity, and it has the maximum possible von Neumann entropy. The analog here is psi max, whose density matrix is the identity, not just a multiple of the identity. And it's clear that its entropy is 0, because the logarithm of 1 is 0. And by imitating a proof in ordinary quantum mechanics, you can prove that a maximally mixed state has maximum possible entropy, and that every other density matrix other than 1 has strictly smaller entropy. The entropy of any other density matrix is negative. So the system consisting of an observer in a static patch in de Sitter space has a state of maximum entropy consisting of empty de Sitter space with the thermal distribution of the observer energy. Now, why did this happen? Well, the original argument that empty de Sitter space has maximum entropy goes back to Busso, who argued that this must be true based on the second law, because the static patch is empty in the far future. Any particles in the static patch will eventually leave through the future horizon in the future, and in the very far future, way up here, the static patch is empty. But Busso said that by the second law, the static patch must be evolving to increase the entropy, so its final state, empty de Sitter space, must have maximum entropy. Now, in the present context, we've defined the static patch to be the one that contains the observer. So by definition, the observer doesn't leave the static patch in the far future. But we can say that in the far future, the observer would be in thermal equilibrium with the bulk fields. And that's what we see in the state psi max. So what we've discovered, first of all, we have a definition of entropy for decision space, which Buzo didn't really have. But following his logic, we predict, his logic adapted to include the observer in this fashion makes the correct prediction for what would be the maximum entropy state. Now, it's possible to show that entropy defined as I have agrees up to an additive constant independent of the state with the usual definition of generalized entropy for a suitable class of semi-classical states in the Hilbert space. The argument involves comparing to a definition of generalized entropy by Wall. The constant discrepancy is simply that in this approach, the maximum entropy is defined to be zero rather than being its usual thing. So the usual de Sitter entropy in this definition has been subtracted from all entropies. Now, there's a limitation, which is that here we only see contributions of order 1, not order 1 over g, from the A over 4g term, because we've subtracted the big term. That was the constant that got subtracted. Now, it would be nicer to eliminate this restriction. I've been given a 1 minute warning, but I'm afraid I'm going to take 2 minutes of the 5 minutes for questions in order to explain something that I think is pretty interesting. So I'm going to be explaining how this might work, but it will be speculative. First of all, remember the definition of relative entropy. The relative entropy between two density matrices is what I've written. And you'll notice that if sigma is the density matrix of the maximum entropy state, so in other words, sigma is 1, then the entropy of any density matrix is minus its relative entropy to sigma max. Now, we can reinterpret the state that I called side empty de Sitter space, the state I called psi ds, as the Hartle-Hawking no boundary state psi Hartle-Hawking restricted to de Sitter spacetime. So here we want a version of the Hartle-Hawking state for spacetimes with an observer. I want to assume that the Hartle-Hawking state makes sense for arbitrary spacetimes in which the observer might be found. If that's so, let M be any spacetime where the observer may be with the corresponding Hilbert space, HM. Let rho be the density matrix for an arbitrary state. And let sigma HH be the density matrix for the universal Hartle-Hawking state, the no boundary state. So this would be a possible general definition of entropy. And as will be clear in a moment, it only involves one arbitrary additive constant independent of the spacetime. I'm just going to conclude in 1 minute by showing this definition gives a sensible answer in one case. I'll consider a theory with many de Sitter vacua m super alpha with different values of the cosmological constant and different Hilbert spaces. So each one would have a maximum entropy state psi alpha max, as I explained, and a corresponding density matrix, which is the identity operator on its own Hilbert space. But the Hartle-Hawking state, in the approximation of considering only these spacetimes, is a linear combination of all the local Hartle-Hawking states. And the density matrix of the universal Hartle-Hawking state predicted to one of the local Hilbert spaces is the identity operator on that Hilbert space times a factor that involves the area of the horizon for that local Hilbert space. And then you'll see that the relative entropy formula, using the relative entropy formula, the entropy of the maximum entropy state in one of the local de Sitter spaces is this, and it's the standard result up to an alpha independent constant. So that's my assertion that we would be off by one universal constant independent of the spacetime, at least in this example. And if we consider small perturbations around the empty state of one of the de Sitter vacua, we'll still get the right formula up to a universal additive constant. Thanks, and sorry for imposing on the question period.
There's one over there.
I'll just speak up. Okay, take around my phone.
Wait for it. Here.
Oh my God. Gabriel, good job. Okay, yeah, thank you very much for the talk. So yeah, I just have a very basic question. So I imagine like your definition of the observer is like inserting a unitary operator in the gravitational path integral, but this doesn't seem to be consistent with your statement that the observer is not introduced, right?
Well,
so, okay. So how would I reconcile these two observations? Well, thanks.
So the model I use is meant to be an idealization of us. We propagate approximately unit geodesic in spacetime. We're described by the bulk quantum gravity theory. We live in a universe of which we have no a priori knowledge. Our knowledge of the universe, all the stars, galaxies, black holes, and everything else, comes essentially from observing the quantum fields along our world line.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. In some previous work, you mentioned a connection between background independence and this Kahn-Cocycle flow. Is there an analog of that in your current proposal for background independence?
Good question. In the previous work, the Kahn-Cocycle flow was used to prove what you could call state independence, that in a given space-time, that's what Kahn used the Kahn-Cocycle for. Kahn was studying this cross-product construction as a way to study type 3 algebras, and he wanted to know that the cross-product algebra didn't depend on the state. And he used the Kahn-Cocycle to prove that. I don't know. Background independence in this sense is much wider than state independence in that more narrow sense. I don't know whether there's such an interpretation. Good question, though.
So in your construction of the observer algebra, it seemed like there were perhaps choices you could have made to have somewhat different types of observers or somewhat different definitions of that algebra.
We certainly could have elaborated. It's hard to give the observer, it would be hard to make sense while giving the observer less than we did, but you could give the observer more.
Right, so if you considered other constructions, would the entropies that you calculated in the end agree with each other for the various states of decider?
I expect that they would, you could give the observer a spinning half particle that has some entropy. So they should agree with each other up to a difference that only involves properties of the observer and not of the distant quantum state that the observer is observing, I would hope. Mm-hmm. I'd like to mention a specific problem for which I would like a more elaborate model of the observer, but I don't know which one. I'd like to be able to define an algebra of observations for the observer between, for example, 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock. Whereas what I defined was an algebra for observations at all times. Mm-hmm. Then you could possibly prove a generalized second law when you let the algebra get bigger.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Edward. So you emphasized that different spacetimes come with different Hilbert spaces.
Yes.
In ADS-CFT, we're allowed to consider superpositions of different spacetimes, so mm-hmm. shouldn't we be allowed to consider that in decider space too?
Well, we can because we are able to do physics non-perturbatively. I'm not certain that the framework for my discussion today makes sense non-perturbatively. I tend to believe that de Sitter space is unstable and that any discussion of de Sitter space doesn't truly make sense non-perturbatively. I feel, though, that the algebra I define makes sense to the extent that the observer makes sense. So after all, the observer was treated as being eternal, which is an idealization. Regrettably, it's an idealization of our own situation in the universe, if I may say so. Not just individually, but even as a civilization.
Thanks.
So I think that this discussion, because I defined the algebra, to the extent that space-time fluctuates non-perturbatively, but it makes sense to talk about the observer as an eternal observer, I think this discussion might make sense. But I don't think we can expect it makes sense absolutely rigorously, because the notion of an eternal observer is surely an approximation.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. It seems like maybe the superposition of having the Earth and not having the Earth might make sense. I mean, even if eternal de Sitter doesn't make sense.
Well, I can even imagine there could be a gravitational, a global topological fluctuation as long as it doesn't kill the observer.
Right, right.
It could give non-perturbative corrections of some kind that make sense to the observer's observations.
Yeah.
I feel the main limitation on this discussion is that I assume the presence of an observer, so the discussion will only make sense to the extent that that is a valid, makes sense.
Thanks.
It's good enough for us, I'm afraid, but.
Could you replace the observer by a small black hole?
I think a small black hole is an interesting model of an observer, and it's been used by Jeff Harris and others. I don't know anything useful to say about it in this context, but I think it's potentially a nice model of an observer.
Does it mean you can build Guettin-Barrett observables from fields near the black hole.
What did you say?
Does it mean you can write gauge invariant observables from fields near the black hole, near the horizon?
Well, I don't know how to do that, but I think it would be nice to allow to take an observer as a model. Okay. I noticed that people... Okay, I'll stop there. Good question, but I don't know what useful... I think it might be a good model, but I don't know what to say about it concretely.
Maybe in interest of time, let's leave the rest of the questions for the discussion.